Hi, guys. Just a reminder that this podcast, as well as many of my online resources, is delivered freely. If you would like to help me get this message of healing out to millions of people around the world, please consider clicking on the donate button on my website, thecureforchronicpain.com. Thank you. Hello, hello. How are you guys today? Welcome to my podcast. This is Nicole Sachs, and you have reached the Cure for Chronic Pain podcast. Welcome to it. I am so excited to be here with you today and share this incredible success story. Some of you have heard on my podcast, a previous episode aired about a year and a half ago, and I think it was entitled something along the lines of "The Most Difficult Case I've Ever Worked." And it's about a woman named Natalie. Her original podcast name was Olivia because I was using it to protect her identity, but then she decided to come public with her story, and her name is Natalie, and it's about a head and facial pain case that I worked with her that was so severe, and she had had so many procedures and surgeries and invasive situations, and she was so down and out that it just was, at the time, the most severe case that I had ever led someone from complete despair to healing. And today is the next time I can say that although I did not personally work with Kitty, she found my work and did my course online and did all of this healing work on herself with her own, on her own power. You know, I wasn't her therapist and we just met for the first time today. Although I can say that, her pelvic pain case is the most severe I've ever heard. The amount of surgery, the amount of pain, the amount of despair, leading her to the ultimate despair, feeling like she could not go on living. This is a story of such triumph, of such depth of despair and such beauty of surrender and such triumph in the wake of incredible medical trauma and incredible lifelong inner child work that needed to be nurtured. And she has done such a beautiful job with it. The conversation that I had with her really moved me tremendously. And she's incredibly impressive in her ability to tell her story and then explain the ways in which she's come to understand mind-body healing and apply it to her own life and continue to apply it today, even as she lives in complete freedom from chronic symptoms. And similar to me, so I have a condition called acute degenerative spondylolisthesis, which is an abnormal structure in my lower spine. And I was told that it would cause me lifelong pain and disability. It causes me no disability and no pain. And I had three babies, even though I was told I would never have a child and all this stuff. But my MRI looks exactly the same. So even though I'm completely free, I have no back pain, I live a life of imposed, structural abnormalities, nothing to keep me from doing anything I want in my life, you know, just because my spine looks wrong, my life is completely free. In the exact same way, look, I'm so excited about this. You hear I can barely even speak. I just finished talking to Kitty, so maybe I usually don't record my intros exactly right after the podcast because I let it sink in a little, but I'm heading off to drive my daughter to college, so I have to do it today. Anyway, in the same exact way as I have this structural abnormality, but it has never had anything to do with my pain and it doesn't stop me about doing anything in life, Kitty is exactly the same. You're going to hear her incredibly traumatic, long medicalized story, but all the things that were quote unquote wrong with her, the ulcers and the endometriosis and the fusion of her bladder and her bowel and all the things you're going to hear about are still quote unquote wrong with her. And she has no pain, no symptoms, a healthy sex life, eats anything she wants. And so it's just a really triumphant story for me to share with you. I'm really excited to bring it. So I'm not going to delay too long. I'm just going to say that if you are interested in diving deeper into my work, just go to my website, thecureforchronicpain.com. My resources tab has many free resources, lots of ways to learn about my work. And my retreats tab has my upcoming virtual retreat in May 21st through the 23rd. And hopefully soon will go on sale my live retreat at the Omega Institute for Holistic Studies in New York this summer, August 1st through the 6th. And I have two online courses, Freedom from Chronic Pain and Freedom from an Anxious Life, both available on my website too, that can be of great help to you if you are looking to have your hand held a bit through this work, which totally makes sense. All right, listen guys, I love you. I'm sorry I'm so overly enthusiastic. This is a really big one for me, and I'm just really excited to share it with you. So I send you love and light. I send you deep connection from my heart to yours. Enjoy this conversation with me and Kitty. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the podcast. Today I have Kitty on. Welcome, Kitty.
Hi, thank you for having me.
I'm so excited for this conversation because I know a little bit of Kitty's story. I've heard her speak. It's odd. I've heard her speak about my work on other podcasts, and I have been able to hear the influence of what I've brought into the world on other podcasts, which I rarely get to hear. You know, usually it's someone talking to me or it's me talking to someone. So that's been really lovely for me. And so Kitty, I just am so excited to hear your story and for you to tell it to me. And so I'm going to open it up to you and we'll see. We'll take it from there.
Okay. That sounds good. So firstly, thank you for having me on. Yeah, I've talked on two other podcasts and I never thought you'd hear them. So that's quite interesting. I talked on the V-Hive podcast and Eddie Lindenstein's as well. So that was really exciting. But for anyone who might not have heard me speak on those, perhaps it would just be good if I go in chronological order.
Yes, please.
Okay. So if you hear rustling papers, it's because I did make some notes because my story is a bit complicated. But essentially, my acute TMS episode happened when I was 29 and in 2019, but through journal speak and the work, which I'll go into a little bit later on, I've kind of tracked it back a lot further than that. So I'll start
right
with my childhood. And my childhood was pretty heavy. My parents were both drinkers and my father's an alcoholic, and it was me, my mum, my dad, and one of my brothers living at home. And it was very volatile atmosphere. And we all had a lot of issues and none of us were dealing with them very well at all. And I think we all took it out on each other. And my mum and dad divorced when I was about 7 and he left. And then it was kind of my mum trying her best, single mum, raising two kids that we just really went off the deep end and were drinking a lot and things. So my home life was rough and I also had a bit of a tough time at school, so I developed a lot quicker than the other girls, so I was quite often singled out for my body and boys would make rude comments about my figure and because I had big boobs, and I actually had boys coming up to me in the playground just grabbing my boobs and running off and things. So
wow,
this whole atmosphere kind of led to being really ashamed of my body and really uncomfortable in my own skin. So that kind of leads up to 2009, which is when I can track my first TMS episode back to. And 2009, I was 19 and it was a really rough year. So my eldest brother, not the one I lived with, took his own life. And he had a really rough childhood as well. He didn't grow up with me, but it was a very sad story, and that was just a terrible thing for us to go through. And I was also in a really bad relationship at the time, and these two kind of huge life events dovetailed 6 weeks after my brother died in my partner at the time kind of going, well, aren't you over it now? Why aren't you over it? And I kind of went into this big cycle of going, oh, I'm too sensitive. I should be over this by now. Why aren't I just over this traumatic life event? And The label of being too sensitive had been thrown at me my entire life by my family. We're just very different kind of people. So it's something that's really stuck with me. And I ended up breaking up with that person. And I got together quite soon afterwards with someone else. And soon after I got with this person, I got a UTI, as a lot of us do when we have a new partner. And
yeah, true.
This UTI started like every other normal UTI. I wasn't really too affected by it, other than, you know, it's very uncomfortable. And I went to the doctors and I got antibiotics, but it just wouldn't go. And I started getting immense fear and panic around it. And I kept going back to the doctors and they were saying, oh, well, we'll just give you a new round of antibiotics and this should clear it. And then over Christmas time, 2009, I just started feeling worse and worse. And eventually I ended up in accident and emergency. And the nurse who was due to see me was so dismissive. I think she just thought this is a teenager just not wanting to go to school sort of thing. But much to everyone's surprise, including hers, I had a really rampant kidney infection. So the UTI had kind of exploded upwards into my kidneys, and they gave me some really strong antibiotics. And a few days later, I was feeling a bit better, but I was left with this intense burning urethral pain. And the only way I can describe it is sort of like a red hot poker in the urethra, but 24/7, it wouldn't go away. And for someone that was already very ashamed of their body anyway, and very ashamed of any kind of sexual organs and things, to talk about it even with my mum was really devastating. And I was with a new partner and I just wanted to be free to go and do whatever I wanted. But I was really stuck in this pain. And so I went back to the doctors and they said, okay, well, we can't really do anything for you, but we're going to send you to a urologist. And so I went off to the urologist, who was this middle-aged man that just made me feel dreadful, like I was wasting his time.
And my goodness.
No, he'd agreed to do a flexible cystoscopy. So that's when they take a camera, it's about as wide as a pencil, up through the urethra into the bladder while you're awake to see what's going on. And they wanted to see, I guess, if I had any blockages or obstructions or whatever. So I went in for this surgery, which I was really frightened of beforehand, and I was still in a lot of pain and they hadn't given me painkillers or anything. And basically they're supposed to put numbing cream on your urethra before they shove the camera in, and this doctor put the numbing cream on and then just kind of went for it and didn't wait for anything to set in.
Right. Oh goodness.
And I was lying on the surgical table, fully conscious, begging him to stop. And just, I was screaming. I just wanted it, because it was so excruciatingly painful and it felt like such a violation. I felt so exposed.
Yeah, of course.
And it was really traumatic. I had three nurses holding me down. And at the end of it, because I made such a big enough fuss that he just kind of got annoyed and just said, right, well, we'll have to stop. The nurse wheeled me to a bathroom and just said, clean yourself up, and then walked off. And the urologist afterwards, when I'd gone back to my mum, who was waiting for me, came over and said, yeah, well, I think I can see ulcers in her bladder, but I'm going to have to do another one of these procedures, and we're going to have to do a biopsy. And I just turned to my mum and said, absolutely not. This man is not coming anywhere near me ever again. And no doctors are either. And I'm just going to learn to live with it. And so kind of without knowing TMS, I took a TMS approach to this particular.
Out of desperation, pretty much.
Out of desperation, yeah. I was just too afraid to let the medical establishment anywhere near me. And so I did. And so because I didn't know about TMS, and I also hadn't met Dr. Google yet, I didn't Google any of my symptoms, thankfully. So I didn't know about IC, and I didn't know about the IC diet, and I just got on with my life.
So let me interrupt you for people who aren't familiar. IC is interstitial cystitis, which is a diagnosis that many people with pelvic pain receive.
Yeah.
A diagnosis that also has been proven many, 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 many times over in my work to be, of course, real. The pain is real. It is not in your head. You're not making it up, but the symptoms completely resolve with the mind-body work. So even if you have a diagnosis of IC that is in no way a death sentence, as it is often portrayed to be, that's yeah. A. And B, the IC diet that Kitty's referring to is a diet that is often prescribed, a very restrictive diet that I know we're about to get into, I imagine. Yes?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. A restrictive diet that is often told, I don't even know if it's believed, but it's spoken about that it can help reduce the symptoms of IC. I personally, and the people that have come into my orbit, have found that it's not very helpful. But anyway, I want you to continue. I just wanted to make that stuff clear.
Yeah, definitely. And I'll go into my trials and tribulations with that clinical term and the diet a bit later. So I moved out of home. I moved in with the new partner who I spoke about earlier, and I kind of threw myself into an incredibly stressful work situation. So I had a boss at the time who was a bully, and I worked for her for 3 or 4 years. And then I was having such a hard time at work for this lady. I was working 40-hour weeks with 2-hour commutes every day, and I wasn't used to that kind of level of work, especially working for someone that was so stressful to be around. And I started getting some other very strange symptoms. So I started getting really bad migraines, and I went to the doctors, and they, you know, without even really probing too much into it, they just diagnosed me, they just prescribed me with very strong levels of codeine.
Wow.
So I was taking, I know, really bad, but I was taking codeine every day for these migraines. And then around 2013-14, I started getting irregular bleeding and bleeding after sex. And then I found Dr. Google, and Dr. Google told me I had ovarian cancer, and I convinced myself I was going to die. And so I went to see a gynecology consultant, and when I was about 24 at this point, and within a 10-minute conversation, she'd kind of diagnosed me with quite a few things, like endo and things, because that was her speciality. But she booked me in for a laparoscopy, which is the surgery you have to have to confirm diagnosis.
Okay, of endometriosis, that is.
Endometriosis, yeah. And even though my bladder and my urethral pain had been fine, because I had let her know that that's where my symptoms kind of started a few years ago, she convinced me to agree to have a bladder distension when I was under for this laparoscopy for endometriosis. And a bladder distension is where when you're under, they pump your bladder full of fluid. I think it's water, but I can't be sure, past the point of human tolerance. So they're basically trying to stretch out your bladder, and then they flush it, and they're having a look at kind of the lining of your bladder and to check everything's okay. And so I didn't quite understand why she was doing that, but I went along with it because people in white coats know best at this point in my life. And I came to in the recovery ward, and I was diagnosed with stage 4 endometriosis, because the extent of my endo is just really quite alarming. Adenomyosis, which is a very similar disease to endo, but it's specified in the womb lining only. Interstitial cystitis, I was then diagnosed with, and with ulcers and kind of lesions as well. So the surface of my bladder had the telltale signs, which supposedly go hand in hand with interstitial cystitis. And I was also diagnosed with vulvodynia vestibulitis, which is a very similar thing to vulvodynia, vaginismus, which is, as I understand it, it's a kind of vaginal condition where your muscles contract, and kind of it can be related to trauma, but it's involuntary contractions of the muscles. So anything penetrating can be hard. So it could even be things like a tampon or just a muscle problem.
I need to say something. I need to say this because I just feel such big feelings around hearing this amount of diagnoses you received. Mm. I am never one to shame the medical community, nor am I one to, even though some of my followers do, but I don't, and nor am I one to tell people ever that they shouldn't get checked out. But I just want to say that I have never heard of any of those diagnoses until about a year or two ago when pelvic pain came on the stage so strong, where people were coming left and right into my work saying they had pelvic pain. Up until a couple of years ago, I never heard the word pelvic pain. It was just something that wasn't discussed, nor was it very largely diagnosed. I, of course, had heard of endometriosis, but I'd never heard of pelvic pain or interstitial cystitis or vaginismus or vulvodynia or any of these things. And every one of those symptoms in many, many people, diagnoses in many, many people that I have heard from all over the world, because, you know, people are doing my work virtually, so I don't know them, have told me that those symptoms that led them to get those diagnoses are gone. Completely gone from the mind body work. So anyone out there listening to Kitty's story, if you have these diagnoses, and I know that the story is going to get much brighter, but I just want to say, please, from my heart to yours, you don't need to hold on to these scary words and these words that sound like real things you can't overcome, like muscle contractions. How do I manage that? You know, involuntary. How do I manage that? So I just want to bring a lot of connection and a lot of heart to the fact that that must have been very scary for you.
It was hugely scary. And, you know, I'm around 24 at this point, and I just thought these were sentences hanging over my head.
Of course.
And there was, I had no other kind of peers I could talk about this stuff to. And the only forums where I could connect with people were doom and gloom forums, which I tried to avoid if possible. So I just felt so isolated and so on my own. And this consultant surgeon, after giving me this crib sheet of everything wrong with me, just said, oh yeah, so what we can do is we can give you really strong chemo drugs for the endometriosis, and we can give you amitriptyline to numb everything, and I can give you Botox injections and all this horrendous stuff and hormones. And I refused all of it, which I'm very thankful for at the time, because it just didn't sit right with me.
Yeah.
But over this course of time, I had a number of other laparoscopies just to try and stop the spread of the endometriosis. No more stuff on my bladder, and my bladder was still fine. It didn't really react. It didn't change after the IC diagnosis. And I was also kind of peer pressured into having the Marina coil against my better judgment for myself, although it, you know.
So the Marina coil, I'm filling people in case they don't know, is a birth control device that is implanted in the cervix, I believe, right?
Yes. Yeah.
And it emits a small amount of hormones in order to keep a woman from getting pregnant. So that's what you didn't want to get, but you got it.
Yeah, I got it. Because they wanted to shut down my periods. So I wasn't using it as birth control. I was using it because it would hopefully shut down my periods. But yeah, that led to a few years of kind of intense medicalization, lots more surgeries. But also what it did give me is 6 weeks respite from horrendous work situation that I was trying to avoid. So I think the reason why I was so up for diving into these surgeries, which had quite horrendous healing times, is because it got me out of work. Mm-hmm. And I did kind of realize, you know what, this is dreadful. I can't keep doing this. So I decided I was going to move back in with my mum and I was going to start uni.
Okay.
Which I thought, you know, that would be easier for me. I'm a sick person now. So I really identified, I held on to those medical labels very strongly and just kind of built my armor up as this sick person and thought, well, this would be good for me. I can be small and at home, but I can still go to uni. So I did. But when I told my family mainly that I was going to uni, everyone kind of laughed at me because I was never very good at school, and just asked me why I was doing it, because, you know, the implication I took from that, rightly or wrongly, was that they didn't think I was smart enough to do it. So then I felt like I really had something to prove.
Right.
And because of this, I decided in my head that only grade A's, we call them firsts in the UK, that will do. Anything less than a grade A is failure, and I might as well not have bothered. So I kind of went into uni with such immense pressure on myself to only do really well. And I'd also decided that I was going to be the really nice one that everyone liked.
Wow, and so, you were really setting yourself up big time, God. Girl.
Yeah, I know. yeah, don't ever do that, anyone listening. Just be yourself much better. Yeah, so whilst I was at uni and putting immense pressure on myself to do well, I think I had another laparoscopy. I was still taking opioid painkillers, the maximum dose a day. I developed awful sciatica going down from my bum down my leg. So I kind of walked with a bit of a limp for around a year, 10 months to a year. And because of the sciatica diagnosis, I then got sent to the rheumatology consultants who diagnosed me with chronic fatigue syndrome and fibromyalgia.
Wow. Even though looking you got back, them all.
I know. Looking back, I probably had chronic fatigue syndrome because I'd been taking the top amount of opioid medication you could possibly take for years and years. But no one was kind of putting any of this together. They just kept adding a new layer of diagnosis on top. And so this personality I created for myself, being this sick person, just got more and more emboldened by all this kind of medical reinforcement. And I was still trying to do really well at uni and putting pressure on myself and all the rest of it. But around 2017-ish, I then developed terrible acne, which I think was related a bit to Marina Coil, because that can happen. I went to the dermatologist. He kind of laughed and said, we'd consider your skin an actual disfigurement now, it's so bad. So then I went on Accutane. So I was starting to rattle like a pill bottle. And obviously the diagnosis of acne and having such volatile skin really didn't add anything to my already terrible self-esteem and kind of self-image that I was trying to portray. Yeah. And I was around this time as well also diagnosed with general anxiety disorder and depression. So just there was a lot going on. so many diagnoses, trying to navigate them, but also apart from painkillers, I wouldn't really accept very, very much medical intervention. I thought I kind of had to have my surgeries and they were still progressing. And I think I'm just trying to remember my timeline here, but I finished up my degree and I'd worked my ass off, excuse the phrase, worked myself to the bone. And I got a first overall. I achieved a distinction and I felt absolutely nothing. There wasn't any sense of reward in it. I kind of thought, oh, I'm going to feel really great about myself. What an accomplishment. But I felt just devoid of anything. So I did what my brain had got accustomed to doing. And I just threw myself into the next thing I could think
right.
of, which is
of course.
To do a master's.
That's survival, girl, though. That's survival. Yeah. And I want to always bring deep connection and compassion to who you were at that moment, because that's what we do to survive. You know, you weren't doing anything wrong. You weren't trying to, you know, be more than you could be. You're just trying to get by. And I so relate to that.
Yeah. Yeah. I think through my general speak journey, I've given my inner child and kind of child at this period of time in my life a lot of cuddles, because I don't know how I could keep up that stamina of just pushing myself. But I signed up to do a master's with the exact same mentality of only grade A's, only firsts will do. And around this time that I signed up for my master's, I was seeing my endometriosis consultant, because I was having really terrible back pain. And he just said, I think it's because I have endometriosis on my bowel, which I do have, and my bowel and my uterus are fused together as well. And he was saying, yeah, I think it's all related to this, so we need to do another really big surgery. But we'd planned it for over a year, and we were still planning it as I was doing my master's. But then another symptom came up, which is that I found a hard lump on my pubic bone, and I found it just before December 2018, I think. And so this pushed my endometriosis surgery right back, because we had to work out what this one was. And I saw my GP before Christmas, and she was really worried. It was very strange, because she actually showed quite a lot of emotion, and she said, I'm really concerned about this. This is presenting like it could be bone cancer. And obviously no services were running over Christmas, so I spent that Christmas convinced I was going to die, and that was it.
Oh my goodness.
And just this fear cycle was screaming at me. And I managed to have the surgery pretty soon after Christmas, and it was a bone tumor, but it was benign, and thankfully. But it was just another surgery that my body had to go through, and it was another surgery in my pelvis. And I kind of used to make light and say things like, oh, it's got to the point now where everyone in my local area has seen my vagina. And I think it was just like dark humor trying to cope with this horrendous situation. But once I'd had that surgery, it was now gearing up for the big endo surgery. And I decided that I didn't want to do it while I was writing my master's thesis. So I gave myself 2 weeks off for the bone tumor removal. Then I dived straight into writing my thesis and managed to get through that. Got a distinction again, which I'm obviously very proud of, but still felt nothing. And I just had this impending dread of, oh God, I'm going to have this huge endo surgery. And my consultant was kind of putting the fear of God into me, because he was saying, you know, I know your bladder's fine, but I'm going to be working on your bladder. And this is going to be, you know, like an 11-month recovery. It's going to be really tough on you. You need to prepare yourself for that. And I was just terrified. I think,
of course,
after 10 years of all of these surgeries and the codeine addiction, which it had definitely become at this point. I wasn't just using it for pain management. I was using it just to numb myself out from everything that was going on. And all these other symptoms, back problems. I didn't know how I was going to get through it, but I just kind of pushed myself to it. And it came to surgery day, and I had the flu. And I went into hospital, and they said, no, you're too unwell to have the surgery. We're going to push it back a few weeks. And so I went back a few weeks later, but none of those anxiety emotions that you build up when you get yourself ready for surgery had dissipated. So I was riding this roller coaster of cortisol, and essentially it got pushed back about 3 or 4 other times. But then finally in March 2019, when I was 29, I had the surgery, which led to this acute TMS episode. And it was in the same hospital that I had the flexible cystoscopy in, that I'd been assaulted by this man. So there were so many correlations. My brain was sinking in. I'd already got the idea in my head that the surgeon's going to be doing something to my bladder. This is going to be awful. It's in the same hospital. And I was already writing my tapes before they'd even happened. And so I had my surgery. I woke up in recovery, and my consultant came along very happily and said, okay, just to let you know, I'm retiring tomorrow, so I'm passing all of your care over to this consultant that you've never met before, but he's very nice, and that's it.
Wow.
And I, in hospital, I put so much focus on, right, I need to be able to go for a wee, because if I can go for a wee, then they're not going to catheterize me. And that put the fear of God into me. And I, you know, I'd already set myself up for the series of events in a way. No, through no fault of my own, but, you know, I'd led my brain down a path that it was only inevitable what was going to happen.
Right. And well, you were in a total panic, whether you felt it or not. Your nervous system was the highest alert, I can only imagine.
Yeah. And sure enough, a week post-surgery, I got that urethral burning back that I got when I was 19, and I freaked out. There wasn't even a step in between being fine and freaking out. I went straight to a level 10 fear, panic, freak out. And I called my GP. I said, I'm 1 week post-op. I need some antibiotics. And I guess I was so convinced myself that it was UTI at this point. They just gave me the antibiotics. No one actually tested my urine. And the back pain that my consultant had promised would go away after the surgery was still screaming at me. And this UTI symptom just grew and grew, and the antibiotics didn't do anything. But I also started having to deal with the codeine that I'd been taking for 10 years for pain management now caused terrible panic attacks. So I was trying to recover from this surgery with no pain medication at all and what I thought was a terrible UTI. And I also couldn't sleep. I just overnight after this surgery, I started only getting about 3 hours sleep a night, 4 hours sleep a night. And anyone that has insomnia or has had a few nights where they can't sleep will tell you that that does strange things to your mind as well.
I am a lifelong insomniac. It makes you insane. It makes you crazy. Yes.
And so I just couldn't put logic to anything. And I just turned into this crazy person. And then this UTI feeling spread into what I've described before as a pelvic buzz, sort of this uncomfortable burning buzzing in my vagina that wasn't itchy, but it wasn't painful at this time. But I was just really aware of it. And it developed over weeks to unprovoked vulvodynia, which felt like sunburn on my vagina. And you can get provoked, which is if you wear tight clothes or knickers and use a tampon. But this was unprovoked. It was just happening all the time. And I couldn't sit down. I could literally only stand up or lay down. And I was just at my wit's end. And my mum and my partner, who I was living with my mum at the time, we were terrified. And I went to this new consultant that had supposedly took on my case. And he just said, yeah, I've got no idea, really. No idea why this has happened. His version of events didn't actually match up with what my consultant said had happened. And he was very dismissive and just rushed the appointment. So I decided, oh, I'm not going to go back to you. And this led to months of me trying out different GPs, saying I think I've got a UTI. I paid to see a number of private consultants. I went to A&E. They eventually tested my urine and said, no, you haven't actually got a UTI. No one could account for this incredible vulvodynia pain. I couldn't concentrate on anything. If someone was speaking to me, I couldn't hear them. It was terrible. And through Dr. Google, through many Dr. Google sessions that put the fear of anything into me, I found Professor Malone Lee, who is a consultant urologist, private one in Harley Street, London, who treats interstitial cystitis a bit differently. And I knew that I had this diagnosis from all these years ago. So I thought, oh God, well, that's just what's happened now. I've just interstitial cystitis now, that's my life. And I'm just going to have to find someone that can deal with it. And that's how I found Professor Malone Lee. And I paid a lot of money to see him, and he tests the urine quite differently and said, yep, you've got an embedded infection. So now you need to do a long-term course of antibiotics. And I think I got 2 or 3 weeks into, I wasn't really convinced either, but I went along with it because I
What else were you going to do?
I know. and it made my vulvodynia so much worse. And then I remember I was sitting on my mum's bed, kind of scream crying, and I was trying to read the side effects list of these antibiotics, and there, clear as day, it said genital pain. And I just had this feeling wash over me of, I've been so betrayed now, and this man has betrayed me, and doctors have betrayed me, so now I don't know what to do, but I know what interstitial cystitis is, and I know I've been diagnosed with that, so overnight, I just said, right, I'm going to do the IC diet. And
okay. So we're circling back now. We're getting back to the IC diet. Okay, good.
So, I knew from my medical experiences that I had all the hallmarks of a medical IC diagnosis. I had the ulcers, I had the lesions, and this embedded infection, apparently. So the IC diet, to say it's restrictive is an understatement. I mean, there's hardly anything you can eat, and it just puts the fear of anything into you. and you become so fearful of food. And I just got it into my head that, well, I can't eat anything acidic because that's going to flare my bladder up. I can't have any sugar because that could give me candida and then that could flare my bladder up. I can't have any alcohol, not that I really drunk anyway, because that's really bad for something and could flare my bladder up, and all these things. And I think at one point there was 20 foods that I could eat and one herb.
Wow.
And it was, you know, to that point. And I mean, without trying to be flippant, all of the only thing the IC diet gave me was an eating disorder, which I'm still dealing with the aftermath of that. And I lost 2 stone in 8 weeks, and I was too afraid to eat anything at all. But I was just trying to kind of manage all of this horrible symptoms, sensations, diagnoses, as best I could. And for me, control is really important, especially as a kid who never felt like I had control, with 2 drinking parents and being picked on at school for having a different body. Control is something that I resort back to. And so I made myself a daily journal, which had kind of morning, afternoon, evening, and I tracked everything. I tracked what I ate, symptoms, what kind of symptoms, anything I was trying to alleviate it, how long I'd slept for, what my mental state was like. Had I exercised? You know, this thing was ridiculous. And I, whilst I was doing this, I got my hospital notes back, which also said something different from what my original consultant has said to the new consultant. So to this day, I have no idea what they did during that surgery, but it wasn't anything on my bladder. So that kind of reinforced to me that it was IC. And I went back to a different GP and I said, I'm going to kill myself. If you don't help me, I'm going to kill myself. And he said, oh, you're just tired. Here's some sleeping tablets and some Valium. Wow. And it was as matter of fact as that. And so I'm quite happy. I'm quite pleased I did this. So I got those prescriptions and I filed them, but I gave them to my mum because I think my mental state was so bad that I would have overdosed, you know, on purpose. It was.
So you were that self-aware. You knew that it was this dark and you should be careful about what you have around. Wow.
Yeah. And all the while, my partner at the time was kind of treating me as this hysterical nuisance and was just saying, why aren't you doing what the doctor's telling you? And so I was feeling more isolated, more stupid, like I was wasting people's time, like I didn't know what I was doing, and that I was just this mad person that shouldn't be allowed to be in charge of their own self. So I went back to that GP and I said, I think I need to be sectioned because I'm not coping and I don't know why I'm coping. Unfortunately, he didn't, but he did prescribe me more sleeping tablets. So I was never going back to that GP ever again. But I thought, right, I'm going to just do one more thing. I'm going to pay to see one more consultant, even though at this point I'd spent thousands, which for a country that has a free healthcare system, which we're so blessed to have, you know, spending money on your healthcare is still quite unusual. And so
it just shows how far you had to take it.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And this particular consultant said, yeah, I've no idea, just like all the other ones. I think the prevailing theory was that I'd had a mass immunoresponse, but that was as far as they got. And so she said, just like everyone else, try amitriptyline. I think this could help your vulvodynia pain. And I'd never wanted to try amitriptyline, but I thought, okay, I'll try half a dose and see what happens. And I tried half a dose, and the next morning I felt like my drink had been spiked. And I just held up my hands in a fuck this. Mm-hmm. I can't do this anymore. This is ridiculous. And it was my birthday, I think, the next day. And I looked up to the moon on my birthday and I said out loud, and I can still remember clear as day, if I can't sit down by Christmas, if I can't have any sort of life, I'm going to kill myself because this can't carry on. This is just, I can't do it. But kind of that headspace gave me so much freedom because I stopped doing Dr. Google and I wasn't prepared to believe what people in white coats were telling me anymore. And so shortly afterwards, I was just on a Facebook vulvodynia group, which I strongly advise anyone with vulvodynia to not go anywhere near. But there was this lovely person on there who just posted, just saying something like, I'm not sure how anyone would feel about this, but I've come across the work of Nicole Sachs. And
oh, wow. A man, you said?
A lady.
Okay, I thought you said a gentleman. I was like, oh no, that's impossible.
Oh, sorry, if I did, no, it's...
No, you might have, I don't know, maybe I'm like so caught up in the story, so I don't know what I heard. But okay, so somebody actually, I really, my heart gets so big when I feel like people are being brave enough to mention my work on these pages, because I know it's not well taken. It's usually
not well taken. It wasn't well taken, and there was a lot of comments underneath strongly saying how not well taken it was. And I just thought, you know, I've got nothing else to lose. I'm in a place of complete rock bottom. My rock bottom's hit rock bottom. So I'm just going to look into this. And everyone around me had thought I'd properly lost my shit, because I just turned around and said, I'm not doing any more medical treatments. I'm going to look into this journaling work. And
it sounds crazy to me right now.
And so I started off with your YouTube videos. And I watched them one after the other. And then I started listening to your podcast from the beginning. And so I'd started getting some knowledge up. I was kind of learning more about TMS. And I was going, all right, this can make sense, because I've had a really rocky time of it. And there's a lot of suppressed shit going on. And I think I had one more outstanding appointment, medical appointment, and I just thought, oh, I'll keep it. And it was to go to a women's physiotherapist. And I saw the women's physio, and she said, yep, you've got quite bad pelvic floor dysfunction. And I thought, oh, great, there's another diagnosis to add to my long list. And then, but what she started saying afterwards was that I needed to get back in touch with my nervous system. I needed to do a lot of breathing. It was so much more holistic than I was expecting. And because it resonated with me so much through the TMS information I was learning, I just thought, well, I don't need to go back to you then. You've kind of just reaffirmed in my head a TMS diagnosis. And so I didn't go back, as lovely as she was. And I just dedicated myself to a journal speak practice, even though I couldn't really sit down at this point because the vulvodynia was still awful and my bladder was still awful. But I just thought, well, it's 20 minutes. And then I go lie down on my bed for the 10 minutes meditation afterwards. Mm-hmm. I use Insight Timer, and I particularly like Sarah Blondin.
Yeah, she's wonderful.
Oh, she's so good. She's just like a hug for 10 minutes. And she gets to the darkness where you didn't even know you could go, but then brings you into the light afterwards. I just love her. But I was also watching Dan Buglio videos with my breakfast. So, and through your podcasts, and I got your book as well. And I was trying to educate myself so much. I learned about being indifferent to symptoms and kind of radical acceptance of where you are that day. And I had this wonderful realization one day through my journal practice that the reason I had been running from doctor to doctor, to London to see Professor Malone Lee and to A&E and to the GP, was that I felt like I just needed someone to listen to me. But through journal speak, I just thought, no, fuck this. I need to listen to me. That's the only thing that needs to happen here. And I remember so clearly there was one day where my girlfriend and I wanted to go shopping, and I was having a terrible vulvodynia day. And I thought, you know what, though, I've kind of learned that you have to feel the fear and do it anyway. So I was nearly in tears at the shop. It was so painful. By this point, it was even painful to walk around. But I woke up the next morning and my pain was a bit less. And I just thought, oh, this is just because I'm doing it anyway. I'm showing that my nervous system is calming down. And I think around this time, I heard about the 28-day challenge, your 28-day challenge.
Yeah, that was one of my YouTube videos.
Yeah. And I thought, okay, I'm going to do the 28-day challenge then. And I did it. And by the end of 28 days, I really had hardly any vulvodynia at all. So,
wow. Amazing.
It was amazing, but I didn't believe it. because our brains are crafty things. And
they are. It takes a lot of repetition for the brain to calm down and go from fight or flight to rest and repair, especially with what you've been through, how prolonged it was.
Yeah. And I just love, you know, you say that if it takes you however long to walk into the forest, it's not going to take you 3 months to walk out.
Yeah.
That resonates a lot with me. But on the days where my pain was less, or on the days where I had no pain, then I scanned for pain. So I was going, okay, I'm
normal,
not in pain.
Normal.
Yeah, I'm not in pain when I wake up, but if I move in this certain way, can I feel pain? Is that pain, you know, what's this going to do? But I remember one time, and this is TMI, but I'm quite an open book these days. I was going for a wee, and my blanket statement is in my head was, going for a wee really hurts, and that's just part of interstitial.
Right, that was your story. That was your story, that going to the bathroom is going to hurt me.
Yeah, and it was pain. And then I was sitting there having a wee going, yeah, but what is pain? What am I saying is pain? Because actually this isn't really that sore. It's more of a this feeling, or it's more of a this feeling. And through meditation, I'd kind of learned that I need to tune into the rest of my body. And one of the biggest vulvodynia epiphanies I had was, I was going, all right, so I've got this sensation going on, but if I feel into my legs, for instance, I have a weird tingling sensation into my foot. So actually there's a lot more life feeling in my body than just pain. And so I need to reframe that in my head. It's not just pain. It could be, oh, I feel a tightness, or it feels a bit hollow, or there's a tingling. But this pain word is causing me such anxiety, it needs to come out of my vocabulary. And so I stopped talking about my pain. And so I asked the people around me not to ask me how I was, because I had been telling everyone that would listen how horrendous my symptoms are for so long, that they'd naturally become accustomed to asking every day, oh, how are you? How are you feeling? And that, and some people took it a bit negatively when I said, oh, please don't ask me how I am anymore. I think they thought I was being rude, but it was a really crucial part of.
Yes, absolutely. That's drawing boundaries too.
Yeah. And I just said to people, you know, my mom and my partner, I just said, I'll tell you if I'm having a really bad pain day. But what I'll say is, I'm feeling quite bladdery today.
Right.
So it's kind of using, you know, I think it's Curable that says don't call pain pain.
Yeah.
So instead of saying bananas or whatever it is, I had the word bladdery, which for me just became shorthand for might be a bit UTI-ish or whatever. And then as a newbie journal speaker, I went through the thing that everyone else goes through, which is you feel okay, you might feel some relief, you're feeling confident, you're starting to feel like you can take off your training wheels, and then you get a pain flare of all pain flares. And I think if you search my name on your Facebook group, that I I needed a lot of reassurance in the beginning, because a lot of people get that initial flare up, which really takes you off guard.
Well, because you know this now, but it's just brain science.
Yeah.
Because when the nervous system and the brain are convinced that your repressed emotions are a greater predator than your physical pain, of course, when you start unearthing this great predator and the perception of your system is that you're incredibly unsafe, what logically would they do? Send up a huge flare to get you back into the pain arena so you stop looking in this place where the snarling tiger with the dripping teeth is waiting to get you. So it makes total sense that it gets worse before it gets better. And just for anyone out there listening, this doesn't necessarily always happen, but if it is happening to you and you're starting this work and you're feeling either new pains or moving pain or worse pain, just breathe. Understand you are on your way out of the woods. You just have to keep walking.
Exactly. Yeah, definitely. I was really lucky as well that through your group, I connected with Whitney, lovely Whitney. And I think she was about a year ahead of me into the work. And so she was just that kind of light at the end of the tunnel person that, and we still talk to this day. And kind of check in, and someone called Sarah from the group as well. And it was wonderful to have those cheerleaders to kind of get me through the initial rocky steps. And through journal speak, I just learned that my inner child was devastated. It wasn't just sad. It felt so let down. And I didn't only have kind of trauma from my childhood. I had sexual trauma from my past, but I had a lot of medical trauma.
And of course.
Yeah, and even surgeries that had gone well on paper were still hugely traumatic. It was still kind of, I went through this stage where I felt so guilty for signing up to put my body through something, which took a long while to kind of process. I felt like I'd done it to myself almost. And that took a lot of journaling to kind of become okay with that and to realize that, you know, I was doing the best I could with the cards I was dealt and I didn't know any better. I had the people telling me this would make me feel better, so why wouldn't I have done it?
And you had no other information. I mean, this is why I do this podcast, precisely why, because without podcasts like this out there and with whatever I can do, you know, whatever level of voice I have out there, there is no other information. There is no choice. There is no other way for people to handle this intensity of suffering than to give their power over to the only people that they've ever been taught have power, which is the white coats, like you said. Yeah. And like I said, this does not mean to say that I am against the medical model. It is often necessary to start there. But when you start hearing things like, there's nothing else I can do for you, I don't know what's wrong with you, let's do another invasive surgery, even though the last three didn't work, it's a blessing to be able to have another option. And this is what you're doing for people right now. This is you. This isn't me. This is you giving people that option. So it's awesome.
Oh, I hope so. If I can stop people running the gamut of the medical world that I have, then it's so worth it. But yeah, I guess through journal speak and meditation, I just learned that I'd been living in my head and I needed to get into my body and feel into my body. And what I learned is that I naturally, and I still do this, I clench up my pelvic muscles, my stomach and my legs when I'm stressed, which for me tends to be a lot of the time. And so even today, I check in a few times a day and I unclench everything. And just kind of learn these things, learn my breathing, learn that I have such a tight chest that I need to breathe in a bit more. And these tools are so, so life-changingly helpful. And then I also did what newbies do, which is I clock watch. And I wanted to know when am I going to be better? Someone who has the exact same symptoms I have, I want to know exactly your timeline, because then I know when I'm going to be better. And I think it was a really early on episode in your podcasts. I think it was someone called Lida, around 9 or 10.
Yes.
She didn't have symptoms similar to mine at all. But I think one of the main things I took from hers was that she was journal speaking for a good 6 months before she had any symptom relief. And it really resonated with me because I still have bladder stuff going on. And I thought, well, I've already seen huge relief in one of my symptoms, so I just need to keep going. I just need to feel more comfortable in myself that I'm on the healing path. And you had someone else on called Joe, I don't know when, but I watched his YouTube video, and in his
My god, Joe is hilarious, isn't he? So funny. I've never met him, but he wrote to me and told me the way my work changed his life, and he said, I want to make a testimonial. And his testimonial is just so long and so hilarious, meaning like it's hilarious for me because I know this work so well, and the way he tells it is so passionate. He's great, Joe.
He's so good. But he said something which really resonated with me, which was that once you're getting better and you're on the path, can't step away from the groups, even the TMS groups, because, and I think this is a very personal decision, so I'm in no way advocating that everyone steps away from the groups, because it really depends on how your mind works and how you heal. But for me, I found kind of constant reminders of symptoms quite difficult. It almost put a bit of doubt in my brain. So I stepped back from the groups a bit. And I just carried on doing the work. And within a few months, I didn't have any vulvodynia symptoms anymore. I came off disability, which I was on. I started working, and I should say as well that after the surgery, I was also working with a therapist, because everyone thought I completely lost it and I needed some professional support. But I told her about TMS and we were working in that kind of a way, which I was very grateful for. And kind of through work we were doing together and journal speak, I ended my 10-year relationship because I realized it was very unhealthy and it was very sad. It was making me really upset. And I cancelled my wedding as well.
Good for you. So, that was brave.
Yeah, it was wild. So 2019 was an experience and I ended the year
and then you got 2020.
I know. Well, I mean, gosh, 2020 has been terrible, but I've had a lot of blessings in 2020. So, and nothing can come to my 2019. So I just feel like that empowered me to get through 2020. But I started 2020 feeling like a completely different person. I was no longer in a relationship that was making me really miserable and I moved out and then lockdown happened. So that one was a strange one. But I did those podcasts and I think I even messaged you at one point because so many lovely people reached out to me after hearing those podcast episodes. And I'm not exaggerating when I said I had hundreds of people kind of going, I've got this symptom and I need help. And for a long time, I tried to message everyone back and have a conversation with people.
Yeah,
and then
I
messaged you going, is it okay if I just don't
yes,
respond?
Yes, I remember
people?
That. I remember that. And I said, yes, honey, you do not need to respond to everyone. Go take care of yourself.
I know. Because, you know, as much as I love to help everyone, I found that, you know, someone would message me going, oh, I've got recurring BV and I've got itchy symptoms. And then the next week I'd have it. And I was thinking,
yeah.
I've never had
this
before in my
life. The brain is so suggestible. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, if you are one of these people that have messaged me, I'm so sorry. I don't mean to be rude. It's just I'm trying to put my healing first. And that's been quite challenging, but I did respond to one message quite recently, and it's only because this lady was a similar age to me and she lives in the same city I do, and we kind of become really close because of this experience, and we've got a really lovely friendship out of it now. But she's almost my Whitney, so when I needed my Whitney, I'm now her Whitney. And
right,
it's really
right.
Lovely because she's making such incredible progress as well, and she's got quite a big social media platform for her job, and she's bringing the message of kind of journal speak and TMS to her platform as well, so that's amazing. But I asked her what she would like me to go through or to talk about and said I was speaking with you, and she just said, you know, it's really hard to get out of the identity of being a sick person.
Yes.
So that was something we spoke about a lot. And she's also just like so many other people, you know, they start TMS work and then they get that flare up and they suddenly think, oh, this doesn't work anymore. This isn't working. Or I need to go back to the doctors. And so we kind of came up with an analogy. I don't know if this is an original one or I've heard it before, of kind of like mountain climbing. So TMS is almost the skill and journal speak is the ropes that you're using for mountain climbing. And so if you slip on a mountain and you're dangling by your ropes, you don't suddenly go, well, my ropes don't work, I'm just going to throw them away. You kind of just have to keep practicing and
yeah.
keep slowly building it up.
Yeah, I haven't heard that one per se, but I think that all the analogies that people come to, these metaphors, are very helpful because in the end, it's about rewriting our stories about what it means to be sick, what it means to be well, what it means to have connection, what it yeah. means to be able to ask for help, what it means to be empowered. You know, all of these are these very essential human questions that are way bigger than our physical pain, but they're begging to be answered through this process of reckoning with our own physical bodies. And so I think it's just so important to know that if you apply the same thinking, this is an Einstein quote and I'm going to screw it up, but it's something like, we can't solve problems using the same thinking that we use to create them. Okay. So it's something along those lines. And it's not that anyone out there or I or you has created these problems. It's that we're human and our humanness is mixed into this societal norm of a pathological model of health, meaning you're fine until something's wrong with you. And then we're going to only look at what's wrong with you. We're going to like kind of take a flashlight into one of the, and without looking at the wholeness of the human experience and all the things that are not hippy dippy therapist talk. It's literally brain science. It's what creates our experience. Our nervous system responds to a danger, to a trigger with a response. And why? Why are we suffering? Let's look at the whole thing. And so it's all about sort of unpacking and allowing us to realize all the different parts of us and then integrating it back up. And so all of these processes where we are tempted to give up are all beautiful invitations to realize that it's just about thinking bigger. It's about widening the lens, which is what your mountain climbing analogy is all about. It's about looking at those ropes and saying, why would you throw away what's helping you? Yeah. Realize that they're always there. It's just very natural to feel frustrated. We've been taught, take the pill. The pill will make you better. And so, of course, if the pill doesn't make you better, you feel in despair. But that's that whole story we've been taught was the wrong story. You know, it's not about making you better. You're already well. I say this to people all the time. You're already well. Now you just need to heal. You're already well. You're whole. You're beautiful. You're perfect. You're exactly where you need to be. But we have to nurture those injured parts, which is so much about having to go back. And I love, first of all, Kitty, so let me just say a couple of things. First of all, see, you're British and I'm American. And all Americans, I can't say all, but many Americans that I know find it to be just so delightful to speak to a British person with all your little sayings for things, like go have a wee. That is just so super delightful to me because we just go, I gotta pee. And then you said you just said a whole bunch of things that were just so like lovely for me to hear because you make the most like awful things sound so lovely. I just had to say that. And so in telling your story, it's so beautiful to see how it unravels, how it rolls out, and how you can then find this center to bring this back, to carry the message, and to bring this truth out to other people, whether it be personally, like with this one person you're talking about, or being on this podcast. And so what would you say would be a good lens into your life today? Because, you know, obviously we've talked about the darkest periods when you were totally asleep and then your slow awakening. Would you say today you feel like a person who is free?
Yeah. I would completely. And just to say as well that, I still have stage 4 endometriosis and my bowel is still fused to my uterus and I still have ulcers in my bladder, but I have no chronic pain at all. I haven't even had to take so much as a paracetamol since that day I decided I wasn't going to take anything else. So I haven't taken any pain medication, considering I've got one of the most painful diagnoses you can have with endo and adenomyosis. But what I would say is that what I've learned and I'm still learning is that you really have to choose TMS and this work. And every time I get a niggle of something or a symptom popping up, particularly when I'm really stressed. So when I'm really stressed, I tend to get what I call shadow vulvodynia pains, which...
Yes, that's a good way to call it.
Yeah, so it's not even that painful at all. In fact, I'd say it's not painful. It's kind of like a tingling sensation. But the first few times it happened, I got straight back in that fear cycle and I was thinking, oh, something else has come up and I'm going to have to go to the doctor. And I just sat myself down and went, you know what? No, we've chosen TMS. This is the path we're walking. And you have to take charge of your healing. And I had to stop reassurance seeking behaviors because I had to stop trying to get someone else to tell me I was okay. I've had to learn that that needs to come from me. And as soon as I do a bit of meditation or a bit of journal speak, that goes away completely. So I don't want anyone to hear this and just think, well, she's completely fine now, because you know, I'm still human and I still have a bit of frequency in my bladder, but nothing scares me anymore. So I've kind of, my nervous system is calmed down to the point that I can just sit with it and go, okay, well, what's actually going on here? So even though I still feel things, I'd say I'm still completely free. And I had a really good example the other day. So like I said to you when we connected this call, I've just moved house. And on moving day, I started feeling this really weird sensation in my bladder and it got worse and worse and it was getting so painful. And I thought, oh my God, I've got a UTI. Again, this hasn't happened to me since the surgery and everything that fell out. And I was having a wee, as us British people do.
I love it.
I do have some good pep talks with myself when I'm having a wee. And I just said to myself, right, we're not going to start spiraling out and becoming a crazy person again, and we're not going to Google. This is going to go two ways. This is either a UTI, in which case we'll get antibiotics and it will go away, or it's a TMS episode, in which case we'll do the work and it will go away. And I kid you not, considering how much pain I was in half an hour, it had completely gone.
Okay, this is so amazing. I'm loving this conversation so much. And I just want to say to you, Kitty, so I want to say something else that happened before we got on the call. When Kitty got on the call, she said, and I'm saying this, it's going to sound super grandiose, but she said it, so I'm saying it, that meeting me for her would be like for me to meet Oprah. So I'm taking that hugeness that she offered me, and I'm going to say this to you, because if Oprah said this to me, I would really freaking love it. So I'm saying this to you. You are so fucking smart. You are one of the smartest people I have ever talked to about this. You get it on such a granular level. I am very impressed by the way you can tell this story. And I hope people out there are getting this. I mean, as an expert in this stuff, you understand the nuance of the dance between mind and body so well. You have an A. You got first marks or whatever you want.
Like, I'm blushing so much. I've gone so warm. Thank you so much for saying that.
It's so true. It is so true. And like I said, so if that indeed is how you feel about meeting me, then I will give you the highest compliment. You deserve it. First of all, you've been through so much, and so much that would really break a person down to their knees. And you've stood back up and you've woken up and you've done the hard work, and you continue to have the exact right mindset for lifelong health and freedom. And I want to actually gently challenge something you just said a few minutes ago, because I said, would you consider yourself totally free? And you said, yes, I am. But I want to say that I still get this sensation or that sensation, or I still had this experience. So I don't want people out there to think I'm totally fine. And what I want to say to you, Kitty, and to everyone out there listening, Kitty, you are totally fine, because it doesn't get finer than this. And that is what I think so many people need to understand, that we have the absolute wrong definition in our society about what it means to be totally fine. That totally fine is bullshit. That totally fine means you're moving house and you get a feeling, which is your tender spot. Your bladder is your tender spot. Just like maybe for me, it's my back or headaches, whatever the thing is, it's like our symptom imperative. That is going to be your tender spot. So your bladder starts to flare, probably not even physically. It's probably just a physical sensation that is brought on by this fight or flight tap, this little tap on your shoulder that says, are we okay? And so, yes, that's what happens when we have big feelings, because sometimes we feel things in our hearts, and sometimes that feeling in our heart, all the things attached to moving and hope and grieving and whatever would be attached to moving, and irritation and fear and, you know, worry that it's going to be overwhelming. All those feelings got too big for your heart. So it spilled over and you got a little tap, 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 and it happens for you to be in your bladder. That's as fine as it gets. Because if instead of going to a place of fear, you can remain in a place of love and self-compassion, which I talk about often, and you can say, hey, okay, looks like we've got some information coming in. And the information is that we're a little scared, or we're a little sad, or we're a little overwhelmed. Okay. If it is indeed something that needs a medical intervention, it will show itself to be such. It won't go away. It really won't go away. Even when I do the work, it will get worse and I will get checked out. Of course, you wouldn't go straight in for a surgery. What you would do is get your urine tested and find out if you indeed had an infection. And if you didn't, I would still encourage you to just do the work, because I have so many people come to me with what they call recurrent UTIs that started out as a UTI, but then for 5 UTIs in a row, and I use the word UTI in quotes, they get clean tests. So yeah. They actually don't have an infection. They have the sensation of an infection, which is so typical, which is the same as a headache or a backache or a hip pain or an irritable bowel flare or fibro. Any of these things are just the ways in which the symptoms show up in you. And so what I'll say, Kitty, with great respect for you and your story, is you are totally fine, because that's the definition of totally fine.
I'll take that. That fits very well with me.
Yeah.
Oh, and I forgot to add as well about the IC diet. So coming off the IC diet has taken a lot of – it's really scary. When you build up food to that extent, and you get such a negative relationship with food, for me right. to put food back into my body and to try and stop this pattern of disordered eating was really scary. However, you can do it, and I do not believe in the IC diet or the Candida diet or any kind of diet at all. I kind of can go along with anti-inflammatory diets or some of them for, you know, for endo and things. There are certain foods that can make the disease a bit worse, but I'll never buy into it enough that it will affect my relationship with food again. But over lockdown, I have started cooking. My favorite thing to cook is Mexican food, so that's a lot of spice and a lot of tomatoes.
Right. I'm sure it's not on the list.
Yeah, so everything that I shouldn't be eating, I've eaten over lockdown, and it doesn't affect my bladder at all. I can eat what I want. I met a lovely person at the start of lockdown, and we can have very normal sex, like a regular couple in inverted commas, because what is a regular couple? But, you know, I've got a very full and active sex life, and it doesn't affect my bladder. The only time it affects my bladder is when I think to myself afterwards, oh, I'm going to get a bladder flare-up, because that's a conditioned response.
Of course.
And then the next day, yep, I've got a bit of frequency. It's never painful. And then I think, oh, yeah, right, okay, need to go and journal, need to go and have a calm down, and then it's gone. And that's as far as that thinking goes. I think what, you know, how you said practice makes perfect with TMS work?
Yes.
It's taken me quite a while. It's taken me up to this point, but I feel confident enough in the work that when a new symptom pops up. So the other day I got really weirdly painful hip pain. And my mum said, "You okay?" And I said, "Oh yeah, I'm just really stressed about something. My hip's really bad, but I'll forget about it in a few hours and it will be gone." And sure enough, it was gone.
It's just you were feeling something and it decided to tap you, tap, tap, tap in your hip. And another thing I want to say in reflection to something you've said a few times in this talk, you're never responsible, Kitty, for your first reaction to something. Hmm. Your first reaction to something is a reflex, and it's a result of something going on in your brain. You're only responsible for your second reaction to something. So if after sex, your first reaction is, ooh, that could really cause a UTI, that's your first reaction. Put your arms around it. That's another thing that you said so sweet. Give it a cuddle. You know, give you those little parts of you, little bit of a cuddle. It's so cute. Give it a cuddle, that first reaction to things, you know, because it's just a sweet baby trying to say, hey, wait. I'm raising my hand. I'm waving my hand in the air. Are we okay? Your second reaction to things is your responsibility, and you can say, ah, yes, I see what's going on here. We are indeed okay. There's plenty of things we can do. And even if we don't have time to do any of them, we can just practice acceptance, practice surrender. I mean, your whole story, if you look at this whole story you told me today, if kind of map out and look at the whole thing, it's just the most lovely tale of surrender, of trying first out of fear to give all your power away, and then eventually going to the darkest part of surrender, which is, I can't live. I won't be able to live if I continue like this. And then having that decision open you up to the possibilities that you might not have been opened up to before, right? The deeper surrender, the deeper acceptance, and then new information can rise. And I want to say, anytime suicide or suicidal ideation is mentioned on my podcast, I am always very clear to say, suicide is a permanent solution to a temporary problem, please, please get the help that you need. Reach out, call a hotline, call a therapist, consult someone, tell the truth. Because imagine with this beautiful future, Kitty, you're such a young woman. What are you, 30?
Yeah.
30 years old. If she had decided to take her life instead of opening her to this and this complete freedom, and not only freedom, let's take this bigger. Do you understand what a light you are in this world? You don't have to answer everyone's DMs to be a light in this world. You live this theory. You bring this energy out into the universe without even your words always. And of course, today with your words. And this is important. You know, we are here to ease our own suffering, but we're also here to be of service to everyone on the planet as much as we can. And every single one of you guys out there is important. You are important. No matter how you suffer, your suffering can be an awakening for yourself and for others. So please, please, please never give up on yourself. I just have to say that.
Oh, that's lovely. That's so important thing to say.
Yeah. So I'm going to ask, we're going really long, but this conversation is so important that I don't care. I want to ask you, as I always ask my beautiful success stories, you are standing out here in front of a sea of people. We just reached over 1 million downloads with the podcast. It's going so well. You are looking out over a sea of people, many of whom could be suffering in your worst moment. What is the piece of advice you would give them?
I think I'd first like to say to all of my pelvic pain people out there that if I can do it and get to the point that I am in now, then you definitely can, and you don't need to keep kind of frightening yourself by checking if your symptoms exactly match with someone else or how long it took for someone. You can get there, especially, you know, if you have any of the scary diagnoses that I have, or you've got food fears, or you will get there, and you just need to have faith in your own ability to get you there. That's something that I've had to learn. Probably my hardest lesson is Nicole can give you all the tools, but unless you believe in yourself, you're going to struggle. And so if you can't believe in yourself, then I believe in you, because you definitely can do it. Anyone can. And for anyone else listening, I just say it doesn't matter if your journey is different to mine, if it takes less time or if it takes more time, or if your symptoms are different, because the reason the symptoms have kicked in are the same for us all, and the way they will heal is the same for us all. And you're already there. You just need to do the work. And I know that there's resistance to the work, and there's going to be days when you think, oh, I really can't be bothered, or there's too much going on, or life's too stressful, I can't add this stress in, I can't uncover all these horrible things in my journal practice. But you need to owe it to yourself, and you just give yourself this gift, because you've got, you know, I had no idea what was going to be around the corner for me. And as I sit here in my new flat that I've just moved into, with a really loving partner, and I've got a job I really enjoy. You know, I had no idea this was available to me, and it's only available to me because I was curious enough and dedicated enough that I gave myself this opportunity. So please don't give in. Please, if you get any flare-ups, don't hang up your towel and go, this doesn't work. The medical establishment is always going to be there should you wish to go back at any point. But what if there's something else out there that could help you so much that doesn't involve a surgery or a pill or any kind of support aid like that? Just please, please try.
Awesome. Well, Kitty, I can't tell you how much I've enjoyed talking to you today. Thank you so much for your bravery, your vulnerability, and your willingness to carry this message to the global community. It is so helpful and so appreciated by me. So thank you for being here.
Thank you, Nicole. You just mean the whole world to me. I think the work you do is incredible, and you are and will always be my Oprah.
Okay. Well, that could be something that I'm going to need to take in for a minute, because that kind of compliment is very, very big for me. But thank you so much for saying that. And thank you for sharing your story. And everyone out there, whether it's pelvic pain you suffer from or any other TMS equivalent, because the way things show up in our bodies is all completely random slash based on what we're open to and what we might be frightened of and what might divert us properly from our feelings. However it's showing up for you, please know that what worked for Kitty will work for you. The work is the same and the results are really stunning. And so thank you, Kitty, for being here. And thank you guys all for listening. And if you are enjoying this podcast, I would ask you from my heart to please go to iTunes and rate and review it. Help people understand what it means to you so they can find the podcast for themselves. And until next week, this has been Nicole Sachs with The Cure for Chronic Pain. We'll see you then. Bye-bye.